Chapter 15. Sea Peoples and Trading Peoples. First, the earliest ships and sailors. Second, the Aegean cities before history. Third, the first voyages of exploration. Fourth, early traders. Fifth, early travellers. First. The first boats were made very early indeed in the Neolithic stage of culture, by riverside and lakeside peoples. They were no more than trees and floating wood, used to assist the imperfect natural swimming powers of men. Then came the hollowing out of the trees, and then, with the development of tools and a primitive carpentry, the building of boats. Men in Egypt and Mesopotamia also developed a primitive type of basketwork boat, caulked with bitumen. Such was the ark of bulrushes in which Moses was hidden by his mother. A kindred sort of vessel grew up by the use of skins and hides expanded upon a wicker framework. To this day, cowhide wicker boats, coracles, are used upon the west coast of Ireland, where there's plenty of cattle and a poverty of big trees. They are also still used on the Euphrates and on the Towy, in South Wales. Inflated skins may have preceded the coracle and are still used on the Euphrates and Upper Ganges. In the valleys of the great rivers, boats must early have become an important means of communication, and it seems natural to suppose that it was from the mouths of the great rivers that man, already in a reasonably seaworthy vessel, first ventured out upon what must have seemed to him then the trackless and homeless sea. No doubt he ventured at first as a fisherman, having learnt the elements of sea craft in creeks and lagoons. Men may have navigated boats upon the Levantine Lake before the refilling of the Mediterranean by the Atlantic waters. The canoe was an integral part of the Heliolithic culture. It drifted with the culture upon the warm waters of the earth, from the Mediterranean to, at last, America. There weren't only canoes, but Sumerian boats and ships upon the Euphrates and Tigris, when these rivers in 7000 BC fell by separate mouths into the Persian Gulf. The Sumerian city of Eridu, which stood at the head of the Persian Gulf, from which it's now separated by 130 miles of alluvium, had ships upon the sea then. We also find evidence of a fully developed sea life 6,000 years ago at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and possibly at that time there were already canoes on the seas among the islands of the nearer East Indies. There are pre-dynastic Neolithic Egyptian representations of Nile ships of a fair size, capable of carrying elephants. Very soon the seafaring men must have realized the peculiar freedom and opportunities the ship gave them. They could get away to islands. No chief nor king could pursue a boat or ship with any certainty. Every captain was a king. The seamen would find it easy to make nests upon islands and in strong positions on the mainland. There they could harbor. There they could carry on a certain agriculture and fishery. But their speciality and their main business was, of course, the expedition across the sea. That was not usually a trading expedition. It was much more frequently a piratical raid. From what we know of mankind, we are bound to conclude that the first sailors plundered when they could and traded when they had to. Because it developed in the comparatively warm and tranquil waters of the eastern Mediterranean, the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the western horn of the Indian Ocean, the shipping of the ancient world retained throughout certain characteristics that make it differ very widely from the ocean-going sailing shipping, with its vast spread of canvas, of the last 400 years. The Mediterranean, says Mr. Torr, is a sea where a vessel with sails may lie becalmed for days together, while a vessel with oars would easily be traversing the smooth waters, with coasts and islands everywhere at hand, to give her shelter in case of storm. In that sea, therefore, oars became the characteristic instruments of navigation, and the arrangement of oars the chief problem of shipbuilding. And so long as the Mediterranean nations dominated Western Europe, vessels of the southern type were built upon the northern coast, so there generally was wind enough here for sails and too much wave for oars. The art of rowing can first be discerned upon the Nile. Boats with oars are represented in the earliest pictorial monuments of Egypt, dating from about 2500 BC. And although some crews are paddling with their faces towards the bow, others are rowing with their faces towards the stern. The paddling is certainly the older practice, for the hieroglyph Chen depicts two arms grasping an oar in the attitude of paddling, and the hieroglyphs were invented in the earliest ages, and that practice may really have ceased before 2500 BC, despite the testimony of monuments of that date. For in monuments dating from about 1250 BC, crews are represented unmistakably rowing with their faces towards the stern, and yet grasping their oars in the attitude of paddling, so that even then Egyptian artists mechanically followed the turn of the hieroglyph to which their hands were accustomed. In these reliefs there are 20 rowers on the boats on the Nile, and 30 on the ships on the Red Sea, but in the earliest reliefs the number varies considerably and seems dependent on the amount of space at the sculptor's disposal. The Aryan peoples came late to the sea. The earliest ships on the sea were either Sumerian or Hamitic. The Semitic peoples followed close upon these pioneers. Along the eastern end of the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians, a Semitic people, set up a string of independent harbour towns, of which Aeri, Tyre, and Sidon were the chief, and later they pushed their voyages westward and founded Carthage and Utica in North Africa. Possibly Phoenician keels were already in the Mediterranean by 2000 BC. Both Tyre and Sidon were originally on islands, and so easily defensible against a land raid. But before we go on to the marine exploits of this great sea-going race, we must note a very remarkable and curious nest of early sea people whose remains have been discovered in Crete. Second, these early Cretans were of a race akin to the Iberians of Spain and Western Europe and the dark whites of Asia Minor and North Africa, and their language is unknown. This race lived not only in Crete, but in Cyprus, Greece, Asia Minor, Sicily, and South Italy. It was a civilized people for long ages before the fair Nordic Greeks spread southward through Macedonia. At Knossos in Crete, there have been found the most astonishing ruins and remains, and Knossos, therefore, is apt to overshadow the rest of these settlements in people's imaginations. But it's well to bear in mind that though Knossos was no doubt a chief city of this Aegean civilization, these Aegeans had, in the fullness of their time, many cities and a wide range. Possibly all that we know of them now are but the vestiges of the far more extensive Heliolithic, Neolithic civilization, which is now submerged under the waters of the Mediterranean. At Knossos there are Neolithic remains as old or older than any of the pre-dynastic remains of Egypt. The Bronze Age began in Crete as soon as it did in Egypt, and there have been vases found by Flinders Petrie in Egypt and referred by him to the First Dynasty, which he declared to be importations from Crete. Stone vessels have been found in Crete of forms characteristic of the Fourth Pyramid-Building Dynasty, and there can be no doubt that there was a vigorous trade between Crete and Egypt in the time of the 12th dynasty. This continued until about 1000 BC. It's clear that this island civilization, arising upon the soil of Crete, is at least as old as the Egyptian, and that it was already launched upon the sea as early as 4000 BC. The great days of Crete weren't so early as this. It was only about 2500 BC that the island appears to have been unified under one ruler. Then began an age of peace and prosperity unexampled in the history of the ancient world. Secure from invasion, living in a delightful climate, trading with every civilized community in the world, the Cretans were free to develop all the arts and amenities of life.